So the premise is they marked the 21st anniversary of the attack on September 11th. And I have a feeling I'm one of, if not the only member of the congregation that deployed for the wars that ensued after. So I have a unique perspective here. So I thought I'd read these, being that it's 10:55 right now. So take yourself back 21 years ago. 8:46 is when the first one came. And then at 9:03, the second one. Those are the World Trade Centers. At 9:37, that's when the Pentagon was hit. And at 10:03, the crew on board one of the planes, or not the crew, the passengers on board, fought the hijackers, and then they crashed. I'm probably going to make some people feel that's not my I was in ninth grade when the attacks happened. And I remember sitting in Spanish class half asleep because I didn't do well in any class, let alone another language. And they wheeled in on a TV and put it on the news, and I was sitting there at 14 years old. So, okay. It doesn't make sense to me what's happening. I don't know why it's so important. Whatever. Then I get home, and a lot of schools went home early that day. As soon as it happened, they got school. I don't remember what happened. I feel like I had a normal day of school. I get home, and I think it hit my mom a little bit. I don't know. We've never really talked about it, but she grew up in Arlington and not far from the Pentagon, so it kind of hit close to home with her. In that attack, 2,977 people died. Over 25,000 people were injured. And if nothing else, even if you were, living on the West Coast, just impacted your mental state, your psyche. And for that reason alone, the attacks on September 11th was a reason hundreds of thousands of people have joined the military. It's things like that that usually get a whole bunch of people to join. And that was not the case for 18-year-old Subhra Huntington. Like, once again, I didn't understand it all. It just was something that happened. I'm more interested in all my friends and playing video games or going out on Friday to see a movie. I went to CMU for almost a semester before the school. I think it's best if we just cut ways here. You have a 0.4 GPA. I found that out recently when I applied for college, and that was embarrassing. So kicked out of school, I moved back in with my folks. I'm like, what am I doing? And they're like, well, you can join. Gross. I'm not a very military guy. That's at ease was never that for me. But I did it because I didn't have any other marketable skills going on. So why not? So I joined, and it's very exciting. You're 18 years old, and the Coast Guard's, when most people think of the Coast Guard, it is search and rescue. It's going out and saving lives, and that's what I got to do for my first unit. I remember my first case, my first big case. I was 55 miles offshore. There was the captain was dead on a fishing vessel, and the other guy was so close to death that he was voiding every time he passed out, and he had to get him airlifted. Working on him for half of the day until a helicopter hoisted him out. And so I remember thinking at that point, I was 19 years old, There's nothing cooler than this. The oldest person on this boat right now is 23 years old. We're driving a $3 million boat, just cruising the ocean, saving lives, making people happy. You know, like, there's no better feeling. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to do search and rescue. That's the coolest job there is. But you don't really get to necessarily choose what you do. So my next 4 years were spent in Southern Maryland climbing up towers that were covered in birds' nests. And all the gross things that come with being in a giant ostrich nest, all the food, everything. So then I come home and Kitty would yell at me because I tried to sit down on the couch. She wouldn't let me. And so I did that for a few years, and I went, I need to get back to search and rescue. And we went to Baltimore, and search and rescue is not a big thing up in Baltimore. No, you're not out in the ocean, you're not offshore, you're in a river, and there's cruise ships that go. So the possibility of saving someone's life is pretty minimal, but what was big there was law enforcement. Something I've never done, but I'm told I have to do it. And it turned out I was awesome. I did really well. Me and my crew had admirals come to our units, give us the first state of Maryland, held a little banquet for everyone. So we were good at what we were doing, and that just it stirred something in me because I was finally good at something. And I gravitated more towards that side of the career. And at that time, the war started picking back up. And I'm like, okay, well, my enlistment's almost done with the Coast Guard. Let's jump ship and I'll go over to the Army. And that all I wanted to do was deploy for the war. That was my sole purpose and intent. And I get there and the recruiters looked at me and they said, no. The Army, you guys take anything. What's the deal? They said, you had too many tattoos. I'm wearing this covering up most of them right now. But even at that point, I only had one or two. So I'm thinking, I've seen people with tattoos on their face in the Army. Like, what do you mean? And they said, sorry. So I didn't get to go. A month later, I had orders to go to the Middle East through the Coast Guard. On board Cutter Wrangell. And then a week after I got orders to the Middle East, the Army changed their policy on tattoos to unrestricted, basically. Now, well, if that isn't God stepping in to saying you're not going because you probably won't make it home, you know, I'll take it. So that is all happening in April of 2015. I'm told I'm not leaving until next year, sometime in 2016. So I go away for a little bit of training, but I've got a year to prepare, a year to have the family mentally prepare for me being gone, and then I get a call while I'm at that training. And the verdict was, you leave in June. I'm like, oh, next June. That sounds so good. They're like, no, in like 6 weeks, June. I'm like, cool. That's great. And not only that, all of May you're gone as well because you have pre-deployment training. So you get to go home for a week, say hi, get your things ready, your boat training. And you'll come back for a week, and then you're gone for a year. And that's what I'm told to do. Let's do it. So I go overseas, and while I'm there, you have a meeting with your commanding officer. It's kind of an interview of who are you, what are you hoping to get out of this time you're here. And what can I get out of you while you're here? He goes, so what's the reason you want to come here? And I'm like, well, this is the closest I thought I'd ever be in the Coast Guard to being able to kill someone. And I remember him just like pausing and looking at me, because at that point I was the 50 cal gunner. So I was the one actually shooting the gun. And then the next day I wasn't. That's weird. He put me as the mouth captain in charge of two weapons at that point. So I had a grenade launcher and a machine gun under my control. And at first I was like, man, God doesn't want me. You know, I had intruder control. And then I realized, oh, no, he just gave me two total weapons to be in charge of. During that time, you go through some weird stressors. You're either really excited because, you know, you're told you have an enemy boat pulling up and you got to kit up and get ready to run out, or you're bored. So those are your two feelings most of the time. More often than not, it's just bored, trying to pass the time. But the longer I was there, and the more times it's, okay, something's happening. Oh, they're pointing weapons at us. And you start thinking about your ship. And ours is only 110 feet long. It was built in the 80s, and it's been so used and abused that the hull is now maybe a quarter inch thick, but probably a little slimmer than that. So if you ever, you know, twisted the throttles opposite of each other, the ship would actually bend. I'm like, well, that's not going to stop any bullet coming in here. And we are all sitting here going, oh, like, we're just being sent out to be the ones that die first, so then all the big guns can come in if something happens. And that reality set in. So anytime we'd be sitting in this small passageway, ready to go, like me and my buddy would bump fists and be like, all right, today's the day we send some flags home to our wives. And like, it's that dark humor that you just develop, because there's no way around it. If you're not laughing about it, you're probably freaking out about it. I had a decent bit of nightmares while I was there. Not that I was ever really scared when I was awake. It must have just been my subconscious, you know, getting all the nerves out. I have dreams where I'm killing my friends or they're killing me. Nothing's ever good when I'm sleeping. But with that, I was lucky enough to not have, you know, the big PTSDs that so many people have come home with because of the war. I've never been in direct conflict. Thank goodness. It was always standoffs. Everyone just sitting there looking at each other, ready to go. No one ever did. And so that was my tour, really. It was a whole bunch of standoffs, staring at each other, going, I bet she won't. And then I came home. And I thought that's exactly what I was supposed to do. Because why wouldn't I? I'm serving in the military. Everyone around me is telling me, good job. You know, you turn on the TV, that's all you're seeing, and everyone's saying, good job. You know, support our troops everywhere you go. And throughout my entire adult life, you know, I was dedicated to serving my country. And then we're here, and before I started coming here, I was up one random morning at 4 a.m. because sometimes I just can't sleep. And I was reading through Matthew, and it was Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which was the scripture read before here. So we look at the first section of it. It says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say that you love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And so if you look at that, you're told to love your neighbor and love your enemy. So you're being told to love everyone regardless of any circumstance. And I can tell you firsthand that there is no love in war or in conflict. So it cannot be what God is wanting from us to be doing. There is no just kill that you cannot justify it with that scripture right there where it says you shall love everyone. It goes on to say, for if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Even the tax collectors, do they not do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? And so that morning I'm reading it and it clicked. I was sitting in a world because that's exactly what I surrounded myself